Today's panel is being simultaneously broadcasted on our airwaves at CKUT 90.3 FM and can be live streamed from our webpage at www.ckut.ca. Check it, like it, be on it. It's a great website. At the end of each academic term, the lectures will also be distributed in a podcast format to give them the largest exposure possible. So to kind of set the stage a bit for this panel, from October 8th to the 11th, the National Energy Board has been conducting meetings regarding the proposal by Enbridge Pipelines Incorporated to reverse and expand the flow capacity of Line 9B situated between North Westover, Ontario, and Montreal. Who will be directly affected by these operations? Who already is? How do the pipelines affect First Nations communities and communities of color? How do short-term economic gains weigh against the long-term environmental destruction? To answer these and many other questions, we have a panel of people who will introduce themselves in just a second. But I want to say first, before we all introduce ourselves, that we're all kind of here against all odds tonight. I personally was just in a police kettle a couple hours ago. I was arrested, got out with a P6 ticket. I think we're all at this demo. And, you know, so what we saw tonight, basically there was a demonstration, anti-colonial, anti-capitalist demonstration against the pipelines. And, you know, the police reaction, especially here in Montreal, is unsurprising, but also I think in a way is a little bit demonstrative of this colonial force that we're up against when resisting the pipelines. And in a way, I hope it doesn't deter us, but I hope it keeps us going, knowing that, you know, we are in the company of wonderful folks who are here on the panel tonight, great freedom fighters. So with that, I'm glad we're not in jail. And I will just ask each one of you to just introduce yourselves and tell us really quick a little bit about who you are and the work you do.
Okay. Sego, Sewa Guego, Amanda Yenjits. Ya dewaga der yonder date sinin waksanoda nunkwahoe neha denogonyoda onendoaga hudinishoni. I go by Amanda, and it's like my prisoner of war name. I don't actually know my Onkwahoe, my indigenous name, yet. But I belong to the Onondaga or Seneca Nation of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. I'm Turtle Clan, and I organize against pipelines.
My name's Cameron Fenton. I'm originally from Edmonton, Alberta. Have been working on fighting tar sands and or pipelines in various capacities for nearly a decade. I currently live on unceded Coast Salish territories in Vancouver, but spent a large part of my student and organizing life fighting Line 9 when it was still called the Trailbreaker 4 years ago. I can't remember anymore. But I work now as the National Director of the Canadian Youth Climate Coalition, working to mobilize students and young people across Canada for climate justice.
And I'm Cindy Spoon. I am from East Texas. I am working with the Tar Sands Blockade. We are a full-time direct action campaign against the Keystone XL pipeline.
Wonderful. Well, again, thank you all for being here. So the way this is going to work, just really briefly, is I'm going to kind of ask each one of the panelists a few questions to kind of get into it. And then eventually we'll also open it up to the room for questions as well. So we'll start out with Amanda. And we're going to go and, you know, look back through the history of Indigenous resistance, but maybe looking more specifically at Enbridge Line 9. I know you've been looking a lot at Indigenous resistance to this project. So can you tell us a little bit about what that resistance has looked like so far?
Sure. So I guess, like, you're referencing and recently looking back into history, you might be referencing the film.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. I recently co-produced a film called Gaston Stansara, which means strength and unity. And we interviewed land defenders from Mi'kmaq and Willistic territories out in the East Coast all the way to Anishinaabe territory in Amjinong. And so it was a really inspiring endeavor and really helped to sort of place where the spirit of resistance is in terms of an Indigenous context, in particular against Line 9 and the Trans-Canada Pipeline, as well as we did talk a little bit about fracking and how fracking fuels the slow industrial genocide known as the tar sands. And I think for me, one of the most important aspects of Indigenous resistance to pipeline development and expansion is that it's often led by women. And it's led by women who are coming from a place of acknowledging their responsibilities as Indigenous people to their territories and to their lands and waters and to the faces not yet born. And, you know, one of my colleagues and good friends, Vanessa Gray, is Anishinaabe Kwe from Omgenang, has been a really strong youth leader in pushing for more direct action against Line 9, and in particular mobilizing her community in Omgenang. And there's been, at least in the last, last summer, and the last year or so, there's been a lot of mobilization there. And we saw the Swamp Line 9 action, which was interestingly executed. It was originally initiated by settlers, but had a lot of support from land defenders and Six Nations. And eventually, when things got really hot on the seventh day, it was largely Ongwahoe warriors who had committed to sticking it out. But it's not just folks who are living on reserves who are taking on the spirit of direct action with initiating and trying to maintain blockades for as long as possible. But it's also urban Indigenous folks who are, you know, attacking some of the corporate infrastructure and the corporate headquarters. Idle No More Toronto has staged some solidarity actions with the LCPOGTOG Mi'kmaq Nation and the fracking stuff there. And so I think right now it's about actually having that connectivity and communication across nations in order to be able to work in mutual aid and ensure that actions are effective in terms of attacking the main arteries of these projects. And so it's more than just blockading particular projects, but also understanding large scale days of action and trying to get investors to be scared of putting their money into these projects. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how the line and mobilizations are going to take off in Toronto and occupy Mississauga Anishinaabe territory.
So Amanda mentioned the film that she just put out, came out online a couple of days ago. I actually want to big up that film for a second. It's really powerful. I would encourage people to check it out. It's up online at submedia.tv and also
ReclaimTurtleIsland.com.
ReclaimTurtleIsland.com. I think, the film and what you just brought up also underscores the fact that Indigenous people are, of course, really at the front and center of this fight against pipelines. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that fight in terms of a larger context of decolonization? So what does decolonization mean to you, and how do you see it in the context of pipelines?
Sure. Well, decolonization is the process of undoing colonialism. And so for me as an Indigenous woman, that means understanding indigeneity and my roles and responsibilities as an Ongwahome person, as a woman of the earth. And so decolonization in the context of pipeline resistance means decolonizing, first of all, our nation-to-nation relationships. And I'm not talking about with settler nations, because you can't be sovereign on someone else's territories. I'm speaking directly to Indigenous nations on Turtle Island and how I'm going to get into this with one of the questions later, but how we have agreements with each other to protect the lands and waters for future generations. And so by decolonizing our nation-to-nation relationships and understanding how we can work in allyship and solidarity with each other and collectively asserting our sovereignty, that is a process. That's a tangible process of decolonization. I think that attacking infrastructure is a tangible process of decolonization. In order to decolonize our territories, that means we need to heal our territories. And there's been so much poisoning over 500 years of colonialism, and the land, Mother Earth, she feels it, and so do the animals and the fish, and the people too. When I'm really inspired by some folks in Athabasca Chippewa First Nation who have talked, actually my one friend Lionel Lapini, who spoke in the documentary about how we had tried all these different types of actions. Folks had tried the healing walk, we're trying walking around tomorrow, and we did some round dances, we tried that. And he pushed a call for hardcore direct action, and I think it's really important for people, as we saw at the demo today, demos aren't effective anymore. The police come in, they kettle you, they declare your demonstration unlawful according to colonial law, and they defuse it as quickly as possible. And so I think if people are going to get arrested no matter what they do, if dissent itself is being criminalized and under the guise of a so-called democracy, then we should be putting those resources in more effective to use more effectively. And so I think that it's also about actually understanding what does it mean to be indigenous. And I think that language acquisition and cultural revitalization are really, really, really important, you know, and that's some key areas to like be activated. And I think that our ancestral memory, you know, like we have so a huge legacy of resistance. I myself am Haudenosaunee. And so, you know, like the Warrior Society was something that was birthed out of a Haudenosaunee cultural context. And we're very close to Ganasatage and Ganawage, where there was, there was the protection of the pines in 1990 and in settler terms dubbed the Oka Crisis. And some of those people are still organizing today, you know, like Ellen Gabriel is a really powerful woman and she like hosted a rally against Line 9. And so it's an intergenerational struggle. And I think that if we can align ourselves as indigenous people, as well as, for folks of color who are not in their territories, you know, to like understand how can we work together. And I think it's really important also to, you know, decolonize our understanding of the social, like the geopolitical context pre-contact, you know, because when I was in Mi'kmaq and Wolastoq territory out east, it was just so inspiring to hear the story of the wampum, which is a lot of people talk about how wampum is a very Haudenosaunee thing, but we got that from the Mi'kmaq, you know, and that's something that they shared with us. And so there is this way that we're connected that isn't physical. And I think that because of that spirit of resistance, indigenous nations, indigenous people are on the front lines of genocide and of the impacts of climate change. I think that it's completely in the interest of colonial capitalists and folks who benefit from the tar sands to try to destroy that spirit, because the people who are closest to the earth are the ones who are most likely to defend it. And so by trying to squash that, you know, they think they can just go ahead, you know, because the Western paradigm of consumerism is just so brainwashing, and people are so disconnected in these like concrete jungles and not understanding why is it that we're resisting. And so I think that decolonization is about cultural revitalization as well as, you know, protecting our territories. Mm-hmm.
We just have a couple minutes before we move on to some of our other speakers. But one thing I want to ask you and I want to read this. It's from a statement on the Enbridge website. So we mentioned the National Energy Board of Canada is having public hearings right now in Montreal on Enbridge's Line 9. So this panel tonight is very timely and apropos. So this is taken from the Enbridge website. They say, developing and maintaining good relationships with our stakeholders, the landowners, tenants, and neighbors along our pipeline system is important to us. I'm trying to not read in a sarcastic tone, but anyways. Enbridge aims to manage our existing operations and new facilities with respect for our neighbors and their land. We pursue this commitment in a number of ways, including consulting with the individuals who live along our pipelines and with those who may become our neighbors as our pipeline network grows. Can you respond to that?
Well, it's a lie. There's no meaningful consultation.
what happens in that in the place of meaningful consultation?
Well, I don't think it's ever happened, to be honest. I mean, it's something that's like outlined in the Canadian Charter. It's something that's outlined in the UN Declaration for Indigenous Rights. It's something that comes back to, you know, Indigenous treaties like the Two Row and the Silver Covenant chain and these types of things. But it's like, this is a colonial empire. It's not about consultation, you know, and Enbridge hasn't consulted with band council or with traditional governance structures. So it sounds like just a bunch of propaganda, you know?
All right. Thank you, Amanda. We're going to come back to each of the speakers in just a little bit, but to hear some other voices, I'm going to go to Cameron Fenton. So maybe to talk a little bit more specifically about Line 9. It's a pipeline that was built in 1976 and originally flowed eastward from Sarnia to Montreal, but was reversed in 1998 to flow westward. So can you talk a little bit about the environmental impacts of this pipeline throughout this time?
I can do my best. That requires remembering a report I wrote in 2009. So I'm going to do my best to try and remember some things of it. But I think some of the biggest ones are that it's already spilled and broken over 800 times in the last decade, which adds up to nearly like close to 10 spills a month kind of thing. One of the other biggest impacts is when you look at a map of Montreal, and because of the building of this pipeline originally as well as since the reversal, and you head to the East End, if you look at there's a map of cancer rates in Montreal just on this island alone, and as if you look at it, it's got little red dots for the concentration of cancers in the city. And as you go east on the island, you end up hitting this one spot where it gets kind of like pinkish and then a little darker pink, and then it's completely red, and it's this area around all of the refineries in this kind of like chemical sector out in the east. And that's where Line 9 has always delivered oil or natural gas for refining, upgrading, or putting on boats. And that's also where the formerly Petro-Canada, now Suncor refinery, that they want to upgrade the coker in to be able to process tar sands on the island would go, which actually would lead to the contravention of a little known air quality law that was passed because of this pipeline and some of the oil being built around acid rain, I think it was, back in the 80s, around sulfur content of refining petrochemicals on the island of Montreal.
So, I mean, when we're looking at Enbridge Line 9, I guess there's a significant change there in that when it was built in the 1970s, it was built to transport, I guess, what could be called traditional crude oil. And now, so the reversal plan includes transporting bitumen from the tar sands. So for our listeners and maybe for folks in this room and especially for myself, who might not know what exactly are the implications of bitumen versus crude oil, can you talk a little bit about those impacts?
Yeah, I think the best way of understanding the difference between bitumen and crude oil is one of the first schemes to extract the tar sands, the story of this, was in about kind of the mid-1970s, well, they were trying to figure out various ways to pull this stuff out of the ground before a guy with a washing machine figured out a process for cleaning it they use today. Someone proposed burying a nuclear warhead in northern Alberta and detonating it underground within the tar sands to liquefy it so they could put conventional oil wells on top of it in order to extract it en masse and make it marketable. Thankfully, I guess they didn't do that, but not thankfully, now they found another process now that really isn't that much better. So the fact is that bitumen comes out of the ground typically in surface mining as a sticky black substance that needs to be washed with tons of water, tons of chemicals. And then the two ways of transporting it are through a superheated pipeline or rail system, or by pumping it full of other chemicals called dilutant. And bitumen is already higher in sulfur, higher in a ton of other things like naphthalenic acids than traditional crude oil, making it more corrosive. The superheated systems are kind of unproven and not really used anywhere, but that's one of the big things they're planning to try with now with oil by rail, is having tanker cars that are effectively ovens on trains going across the country to move oil that's unconventional, similar to the stuff that caused the catastrophe in Lac-Mégantic. So it has a massive implication in terms of the corrosivity within pipelines, within this 45 or plus year old pipeline, as well as the impact on the environment and the fact that there's actually no way proven to clean up a bitumen spill at all within especially a body of water, which we're seeing now in the Kalamazoo spill, that you just can't clean it up.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually glad you brought up Lac-Mégantic, because that is something that is on the minds of a lot of people now when we're talking about pipelines. So, of course, there was the tragedy that happened there, the train oil tanker explosion that killed, I can't remember the exact number, but definitely over 40 people. And we've heard Lac-Mégantic brought up by Stephen Harper, by other proponents of pipelines, saying, okay, look, like transporting oil by train might not be so safe. Pipelines are the way to go. What should be a response to that?
I think the basic response is this isn't a problem of pipelines or rail. This is a problem of oil, a problem of the tar sands. It's the same way. It's the exact same argument of we either need to use oil or frack. It's not one or the other. We need a transformation of not just our energy system, but our society, of one that values people, the planet, and justice over simply profit for the wealthiest corporations on the planet. Mm.
So, of course, Cam Fenton, you're part of the Canadian Youth Climate Coalition. Can you talk a little about the work that you're doing with the coalition to oppose the tar sands and oppose the pipelines?
I mean, we do a number of things. Probably the most the biggest insurgent right now is that we run a campaign in Canada related to divesting public institutions from the oil, coal, and gas sector. But tied to that is that a lot of what we do and a lot of like what our pushing forward in the strategy is thinking about the fact that we can't stop the tar sands one pipeline at a time. We've been doing a good job of choking it and stopping it and slowing it down, but we need to learn and figure out strategies that can shut these things down at the source, that can stop the expansion, because right now it's on track to grow three times the size that it currently is within the next decade. It could hold upwards of 400 gigatons of recoverable carbon, which is almost the planet's entire carbon budget. It's over 25 times our country's. And I think that one of the big things that we do is that, and personally coming into this space, is that when we talk about what sort of we work on and come into is inheriting or, you know, the quote unquote youth climate movement, is that the climate movement is historically very white, very middle class, and very dominated by a politic that comes from that. And so a lot of the work we do through projects like Power Shift is trying to challenge that and trying to build something that recognizes that climate justice isn't about fighting pollution. It's about fighting polluters, and it's about building alliances and building sort of a movement that that recognizes that while climate change may be something that brings us together or may be a massive issue of things like tar sands, that we can only address them when we recognize that justice is the fundamental goal.
Thank you, Cameron. We're going to move to Cindy Spoon, who is, of course, with us all the way from Texas, which is very exciting. I just wanted to mention, though, that I'm addressing these questions to specific people on the panel, but if anyone wants to jump in as well afterwards to add something to someone's response, feel free. And then we will, of course, go to questions from the room in just a little bit. So, Cindy, you, of course, have been part of the Texas tar sands blockade. So for those of us here who are unfamiliar with what that has been all about, can you fill us in and tell us about the Texas tar sands blockade?
Of course. The tar sands blockade is a full-time direct action campaign that's been running down in Texas against TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline. Over the last year, we have deployed over 30 direct actions, and we've also supported organizing that's going on in Houston refinery communities to make sure that those being most affected by the tar sands, that their voices are included in the national dialogue about KXL. Now we're seeing more and more grassroots movements spring up in the United States against different tar sands projects, and we're helping to support those too. To talk a little bit about how we came to being, I'm gonna talk about the resistance to Keystone XL before the tar sands blockade. So back in 2011, there were rolling sit-ins at the White House, which is now known as Tar Sands Action, asking Obama to please deny Keystone XL. These sit-ins were being mostly organized by big NGOs in the United States. In 2012, which was an election year for Obama, y'all might have heard about that.
We sometimes hear about that up here in Canada, yeah.
Obama and TransCanada worked out a political mechanism that benefited both of them. So they split this project in half, and Obama got to appease his constituents, Democrats and liberals, by saying, "Okay, I'll consider your claims. I'll take a little bit longer and I'll review this project so that the NGOs could claim this as a victory." And he came down to the South, where I live, in red states that never vote for Obama anyways, and gave a speech in front of a huge stack of TransCanada's like pipes stacked up, endorsing the pipeline, saying that he was going to expedite it, that he was ready to build this thing. And because it was an election year, a lot of these NGOs and progressives did not want to go against Obama. And so they kind of sold out Texas and Oklahoma and backed away from any organizing that would be happening there against this project. So the tar sands blockade started. It was organized mostly by Texans and different landowners that were going to be directly affected by this thing. And it was really powerful to see Texans rising up and protesting the fossil fuel industry, because the state that I live in is completely dominated by oil and gas. So because Obama actually endorsed the pipeline where I live, there is no regulatory process. There is no politician. There's nothing that could stop this thing anymore within the system. We have absolutely no choice but to use direct action to stop this. So what we've been doing is we built tree sits and different blockades in the actual path of where the pipeline was proposed to go. We built a wall that was 30 feet by 120 feet and forced TransCanada to go around us. I guess I just want to like flag one of the things that I was just saying, that there is no process to stop these things, that we are in a situation right now, in a political situation, where the fossil fuel industry is literally the most powerful institution, and it's running rampant, and it's running unchecked, and it's gambling with our futures, and it's gambling with our health.
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful video as well about the tar sands blockade that people can check out. If you search Mutual Aid Media, did a really great 10-minute video. Or I'm sure if you just use that thing people call the internet, search tar sands blockade, there's some stuff up there. One of the things that really struck me from one of the videos is people talking about how, you know, there's no kind of illusion that, you know, you folks down in Texas just doing these blockades, these direct actions is going to somehow stop the pipeline. So can you talk a little bit about how you see the actions that people are undertaking in Texas in terms of fitting in with a larger resistance?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. We were never under an illusion that we would just like build this one blockade and that would stop this thing. But we were hoping to inspire others and begin to see these direct action tactics taking place in different campaigns. So now we're seeing resistance in Michigan against Enbridge. We're seeing resistance in Utah against a Canadian company called U.S. Oil Sands.
Ironic.
There were indigenous folks up at the Red Lake blockade that have been occupying an Enbridge site for months now. And I wanna kind of echo something that Cam previously said, that we really cannot be focusing and playing this like whack-a-mole game on different pipeline projects, different infrastructure, and that we really need to be focusing on stopping this thing at the source, stopping tar sands where people that, you know, in the U.S., it's really about the Keystone XL right now. That's what all that's making it into mainstream media. But if we stop that pipeline, are people in the United States going to declare like campaign over, we won, when people up here are still living by the tar sands mine, still getting cancer from the tar sands mine? So,
mm-hmm. I mean, that brings up another really interesting question. If you look at the tar sands in northern Alberta, if you look at the communities that are impacted, it's so overwhelmingly, you know, indigenous communities who are living downstream from these toxic tailing ponds and, you know, from the smokestacks that are just spitting out toxins into the atmosphere. Maybe to give us a picture of what's happening in the States, and especially, you know, to bring the lens of environmental racism, can you talk a little bit about communities of color who are impacted by Keystone XL?
Of course. Yeah, because this is the Tar Sands Reality Check Tour. A good reality check is that this pipeline and the tar sands in general disproportionately affects people of color. So the process that TransCanada goes through to get the rights to what they call the easement, that's where the pipeline runs through, is they approach landowners, mostly white landowners, and even though everyone is getting screwed over the pipeline, it's a bad deal for everybody. No one's benefiting from it, but they approach white landowners and they go through this facade of, can we get your permission? We'll give you some money, or you can sign over. Eminent domain is the legal tool that they use in the United States to take people's private property away to build things like pipelines and highways. So they go through this facade of getting consent from landowners. Like I said, mostly white people owning property. But we know that at both ends of the pipeline, where people are the most affected at extraction and at the site of refining, it's communities of color, and TransCanada does not go through this same facade with them. So once again, everyone is getting screwed over by the pipeline, but it's just even just like the need for consent. I know down in the refinery in down in Texas, the pipeline actually splits into two, and it's getting refined in Houston and in Port Arthur. Port Arthur is like 98% African-American community. Where it's being refined in Houston is a community called Manchester, mostly a Chicano neighborhood, a lot of undocumented folks that actually can't challenge these things because they don't have the legal papers that the United States requires. So they're being bullied and targeted because of their status, their legal status. And then we know up on this end of the pipeline, like you were just saying, that it's like mostly all indigenous folks living around the site of extraction. So this pipeline alone is a sheer example of environmental racism.
Mm-hmm. I want to actually stay on this topic, but bring it back to Amanda. I think there's just this very blatant, there are these racist dynamics that come into play when we're looking at pipelines. Can you talk a little bit about white supremacy and how you see that playing into this struggle?
Sure. Yeah. So I feel like people get really alarmed by the term white supremacy when like it's used. And they're like, oh my gosh, you mean like the KKK and stuff? And it's like, you don't have to be wearing hoods and burning crosses in order to be playing into white supremacy and participating in it. The tar sands are about a wave of colonial capitalism that is in this trajectory of progress. And this definition of progress is embodied in white supremacy. And so it requires the theft of indigenous lands and the murder of indigenous people in order to function, you know? And it's like indigenous folks in Turtle Island and like folks of color, people who are disproportionately impacted by these projects are the ones who are, I think, have the most stakes in resisting it. And it seems like, because it comes down to survival in that sense. So there's like obviously the corporations and there's the government and there's all this sort of stuff that's playing into the hegemony of white supremacy and the culture of whiteness that allows these things to be understood as great. You know, like consumer capitalism wouldn't exist if it wasn't for theft of indigenous lands and Turtle Island and the enslavement of black folks in order to build this wealth. You know, it's all about death and destruction. And theft, you know, that's theft of bodies, theft of lands. That's exactly what this stuff is about, you know. But like even within like the radical movement, there is so much co-optation and white supremacy is like runs rampant within big green ENGOs. You know, as we know, like, I mean, I'm sitting at the table, you know, there's...
And sorry, just to explain ENGOs.
Oh, yeah, environmental non-government organizations. Yeah.
Thank you.
And like, I guess, I don't know if this event is actually, I don't know if it's a Tarzan's Reality Check Tour event. Technically, I thought it was like Under the Weather, CKUT. But I mean, I think that as a grassroots indigenous organizer, I'm very, very like cautious of big green non-governmental organizations. Because like when we look at the history of so-called resistance, all we see is co-optation and then erasure of sovereignty and of autonomy. And, you know, like if we look at, you know, like, for instance, the Boreal Forest Agreement, you know, or, you know, the Great Bear Rainforest Agreement. What happened was indigenous communities were agreed to work with ENGOs and like Greenpeace, like Sierra Club, you know, like Forest Ethics, and said, okay, these are the protocols under which we're going to work together. And then those ENGOs said, actually, fuck you. You know, we are going to undermine your sovereignty and completely like throw you under the bus and create and organize deals, you know, with industry on your territories without your consultation and basically sign away these resources that don't belong to us because it seems like a more winnable fight, you know. And it's just like folks like Sephora Berman, you know, and so I'm really critical and like very unsure about things like the Tar Sands. What is that? Tar Sands Solutions Network, which I think, aren't you on the steering committee for that, Cameron? Yeah. And so like, I think that shit's really fucking suspicious. And I'm really, you know, like power shift and this kind of stuff. And it's just like all about like pushing particular agendas. And I got to say, like the Tar Sands Reality Check Tour is like holding, like it's a fist holding like a wind turbine, you know? And to me that speaks of like pushing for, obviously there's some kind of like green technology is okay, but like, I'll tell you, wind farms are on stolen native land. you know? And so if we're not actually critically engaging with the roots of white supremacy and how capitalism and colonialism are intertwined, and we're not giving power to grassroots people and listening to grassroots struggles, and those aren't the lead of the struggle, then there's probably a problem, you know? Because co-optation is just so eminent. And I think that another like major piece is that the conversation then becomes about sustainability. And to me, sustainability is just code for ongoing colonialism. I think that capitalism isn't sustainable, and that's good.
Thank you, Amanda. Yeah. So I'm going to throw out a question to, I guess, the whole panel. And then again, we will open it up for questions from the room after that. My question is going to have a tinge of optimism to it, because for folks who know me, I'm kind of like the eternal optimist. So I was out west in so-called British Columbia, unceded Wet'suwet'en territory, which is, I guess, up in the north. It's about we were on a school bus, so it took us a long time to get up there, but it was about a two-day drive. And so there is an amazing struggle happening up there, if people haven't heard of it, or maybe folks have, and it's called the Unist'ot'en Camp. So it's the Unist'ot'en clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation for the last 4 years have gone out on their land and set up a blockade to stop seven proposed oil and gas pipelines from coming through their territory. And they've been extremely successful in doing this. Anytime surveyors or pipeline workers are sent out to the land, they literally go and chase them off. They just had a helicopter come in on July 20th, and they managed to chase the helicopter away. And so I was up there in July, and I was doing an interview with Frida Hewson, who's the spokesperson for the Unist'ot'en camp. And I asked her the question, you know, what would be the impact of these pipelines if they came through your territory? And her answer is just something that is going to stick with me forever, because she just looked at me and she said, well, there's not going to be any impact because they're not coming through. And it was just this uncompromising determination to stand up and say no. And so my question, you know, and kind of an analysis I've heard articulated from other folks, is we have the Unist'ot'en holding it down and doing this amazing job of blocking pipelines to the west. We have, you know, folks down in Texas who are doing an awesome job, you know, doing these direct actions and hopefully going to stop Keystone XL from going south. And then we have the resistance that will hopefully build against Line 9 and Enbridge coming east. So I guess it leaves the question that, you know, if we can manage to block the tar sands pipelines going these directions, I mean, they could always take it north across the North Pole, and they shouldn't, you know, maybe they haven't ruled that out.
They're already trying to.
Okay. Well, maybe I'm being a little bit too optimistic, but do you guys want to touch on that? Like this idea of trying to block the tar sands from different directions. Was I being way too optimistic there?
There's always going to be some way they're going to try and get it out. They will come up with like a dirigible to bring this stuff out, because the fact is that it's the wealthiest corporations on the planet. They're making money hand over fist on it, and they're going to continue to do it until we can't stop pipelines alone. We have to go from stopping pipelines to rolling that back to stopping it at the source. But both of those things require building, and like not just building a movement, but that's the first step, because I absolutely agree with what Amanda brought up, and that I came into a movement and came into this through a policy-oriented, top-down, very NGO-heavy movement, and try to bring this thing that's not that into those spaces, because I have access to it. But what we need to do is start by building a movement that's fundamentally grounded in justice, that can push for a society that's grounded in justice, but that also recognizes, even and while we're doing this, maybe we can stop every tar sands pipeline. Of those 9 pipelines that the Unist'ot'en are trying to stop, most of those aren't tar sands. Most of those are fracking. There's always going to be something else. The fossil fuel industry, until we put them completely out of business, is going to continuously try to make money off exporting, extracting, and burning the planet and burning these fossil fuels, and doing so in a way that violates people's rights, and primarily indigenous and people of color's rights around the world.
Did you guys want to touch on that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think my answer would sound pretty similar. Like, I think industry is going to keep making more and more pipeline project proposals to split up our movement and to split up resistance, to overwhelm us, and that we need to focus on stopping it at the source. I also would just highlight that there's definitely already tar sands flowing in several places. Cameron did mention the Kalamazoo spill that happened in Michigan, but actually earlier this year, there was also a spill down in Arkansas in Mayflower, the Pegasus pipeline. And that pipeline crosses Keystone XL. So like while these Texans were trying to fight this new thing that they thought was coming to their homes, they were unaware that there was already tar sands flowing under the ground in the exact same place.
I think fracking has a huge role to play in this conversation. And for me, you know, part of the reason that I've been focusing obviously on Line 9 and like with the upcoming the Energy East pipelines is because they come through in and around like my territories and shared territories with neighboring nations like the Anishinaabe. And so this is like very much like this is like, you know, like kind of like there's like that personal element of the struggle there. But fracking fuels tar sands, you know, so I think that we have to put a lot of, you know, give a lot of support to the anti-fracking movement and find ways to bring that support within our communities as well, and think critically about how, you know, what kind of energy, you know, we're using and where it comes from and this kind of stuff, you know. And I think for me, you know, obviously I'm coming from like an indigenous perspective here, and so I think that asserting our sovereignty is you know, I think that's like the main piece. But I also think that the folks who benefit, you know, these big corporations, they like seem like these ominous, you know, entities, but they're like people with names and addresses. And I think that if we were to have like a well orchestrated, you know, like direct action campaign against the physical infrastructure, as well as like within like urban context, like, you know, making it really hard for them to actually do day-to-day business. You know, it is so disrupting to actually have a sit-in in your corporate office that like shuts down your headquarters for any number of days. That costs them money. You know, like direct action, you know, going in and taking pumping stations and holding them for as long as you possibly can costs them a shit ton of money. And the more expensive we can make it for them, I think the more likely we will be in winning. Because the other thing is too, part of the reason that we Unison are doing so good is because they're an economic threat. It makes it harder for investors to feel like if they go ahead and say, if Encana or EOG, for instance, they divested from the Pacific Trails pipeline because they're like, whoa, those natives are unpredictable, you know. and so you know, if you can get them on that level, you know, like if you can like impact their stocks, if you can do these types of things where they don't feel like they have this, you know, this secure investment in order to put their money to, you know, because there's so much infrastructure, like even just pipe from pipelines to super tankers to the process of refinement, it's not cheap. You know, tar sands are one of the most expensive ways of getting fossil fuels, you know, to people's homes and stuff. So I think if we can try, you know, to work together, then, you know, I like that block it from the east, from the west, south, north. Do what we can.
Yep. Surround the tar sands.
Surround the tar sands.
Until we shut them down.
Exactly. And like, also, I think too, I mean, whenever there, if, you know, like if there ever calls for action, you know, direct action straight from the heart of the tar sands, like, I don't care if you don't have any money, like hitchhike your ass over there and like show up. You know, if there are those calls, you know, to shut down the highways and stuff, we have to make sure that we're physically there, you know, because like, we need bodies for that kind of stuff to be successful. So
I'm just going to take a second to remind our listeners, for folks who aren't in this room, that you're still listening to CKUT. This is the Under the Weather special series. This is a wonderful thing to be live broadcasting from McGill, having a panel like this, and of course also on the airwaves. So what we're going to do now is we're going to open it up to the room for a few questions. We have a microphone, and we will be with you until 8 o'clock on the air, but we can, you know, for folks who are here in the flesh, that was a funny way of putting it. But anyways, we can keep on going for a little bit longer because I think this is an important discussion. So if you have a question, just put your hand up and you can come up to the side here. So we'll definitely take questions, and We see one person. So come on up. And as folks are coming up, I'm just going to do that thing of, you know, filling the radio silence. CKUT's funding drive, our annual funding drive, is coming up very, very soon, happening October 24th to November the 3rd. It's the one time of year where we reach out to the community to help fund wonderful stuff like this, where we can bring our equipment and bring you voices like this. And we'll go to a question now.
Hello. So you were talking about how there's a lot of structural racism and everything that's going on, and every time there's some sort of movement, like the civil rights movement, you think you've won, but then there's more structural racism going on, like, you know, school to prison pipelines, and every time you think there's a new environmental solution, like carbon offset projects, it's really just some sort of mask for, you know, governments and businesses doing what they usually do, plus getting carbon credits out of it. So are we just doomed to eternally fight, or does this end at some point?
What a question.
I heard an abolish capitalism in the back, but who wants to take that one on?
I can start. Well, they don't call it struggle because it's easy. But I mean, I think it's a really good point, you know, and it's just like, from like, it's just like our ancestors have been fighting against like all kinds of different, you know, types of abuses of power for hundreds of years, you know, and as various empires grow, so does their insidiousness. And so something that I've been trying to focus on is intergenerational healing, you know, and so it's just like, I think what we need to do is also like bring up little warriors, you know, because it's not going to be like, okay, we shut down the tar sands and now we like won. And like, we have like this horizontal society where like land is back in the trust of indigenous nations and like racism is abolished. You know, I will not live to see that day. And it's just like, this whole process has like poison Mother Earth, you know, and like we can only heal her as deep as like our roots of resistance will go. And so I think it's important to understand that we need to also take care of each other, you know, and like in order to build like strong communities of resistance. And we can't just say the tar sands are shut down. We gotta, like, that's still a toxic site, you know. We need to try to heal that land. And so we also need to try to heal each other as people. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of trauma suffered from capitalism, and there's a lot of intergenerational trauma suffered from colonialism. And if we can find ways of centering healing as part of our survival and part of our struggle, then I feel there's more hope, you know. But I guess I'm not going to say like that we will necessarily attain that space. And I feel like I feel like I have a responsibility to at least, you know, fight tooth and nail to try to see that someday, maybe in seven generations, it is there.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, I would add that I think that resistance is a lifestyle, and I do think that it is ongoing, which can seem overbearing, but it's also, I found that the strongest bonds that you can form with people is through mutual struggle, and that doing this work, you meet the best people worth knowing that are also involved in this. And if, as far as it relates to climate, I know you brought up a lot of other issues, but as far as it relates to climate, I'm pretty cynical, and we hear about like stopping climate change, and I don't think that that's possible. I think we're already living in it. I think the climate has changed. So we're not going to stop climate change, but I think that what we can do is preserve the places that we still have left. And I think we have an obligation to do that. So
do you want to touch on that?
Sure. Yeah. Like Cindy said, we're never going to stop climate change. I mean, we're already almost a degree and not even at 1 degree. And we've seen Hurricane Sandy wreck the East Coast from the Caribbean to New York City this summer. Toronto, Southern Alberta both got demolished by floods, and we're living in the climate crisis. We're living in what was threatened 40 years ago, and we've still failed to see political action. I think to touch on, and taking it off of what Cindy said, is that no, I don't think we're going to solve a lot of these issues, but I think that the society and we can build through fighting back against the largest corporate power, the wealthiest corporations on our planet. And I think that in doing that, we can build something amazing. And it's something that I often can't even really comprehend or think about what it could be. But I think there's a lot of potential power in the size and scale of the struggle we need to build to fight these things, you know, even just the tar sands on an, you know, continental scale, let alone a global scale, let alone the fossil fuel industry around the planet, is we'll be connecting people in fighting possibly, you know, the one of the biggest fights that our society has ever faced.